Queen Fila will do next. Gree fixed Daria with a hard stare. I judge people by their actions, not their station. I'll judge Fila that way. And I'll do the same for the Admiral. Whatever she was at birth, I know what she is now. He paused a few steps before Daria and lowered his sword, planting its point in the ground before him. You still have my sword, Admiral Hollardy, he said, and my respect, and for, damn it, my love. A few sailors cheered, then a few more people. People started stepping forward, some of them jostled or jostling. Punches were thrown, some shouts were raised. But by the time Daria's heart had beaten out a minute, three-quarters of her fleet had gathered around Gree, and they were cheering her name. She tried to hold back the tears, but in the end she had to let them flow. She had lost someone she had thought was a friend, and yet she had gained not just her whole crew, but her very self back. Of over 1,000 sailors in Admiral Hollardy's fleet of 6 ships, under 200 chose to leave her command. None offered violence, although once or twice leading up to sunrise, Daria feared that conflict might erupt. She guessed that in the end, even most of those who were left were juggling their decision and questioning inbred beliefs when set against the woman they had known and respected for so long. She gave them a ship. She could have left them stranded on Igler's End, but that would have left her short crewed across 6 vessels, rather than fully crewed across 5. Where they were going, that would not be a good idea. Sailing into a potential battle, she wanted her crews and ships to be at their prime. Gree feared that those she'd let leave might end up fighting against them, but Daria thought not. She hoped not. Confused, saddened, and also relieved at the weight of guilt that had been lifted from her shoulders, Daria proudly stood at the bow of the Nyadin as it left port, 4 other battleships following them out. And then she saw something incredible. In the rosy light of dawn, several smaller vessels accompanied them. Then several more. Sailing ships, fishing boats. All seaworthy, but none of them even a 20th the size of the Nyadin. As they came closer, she saw who was sailing them. Bajuman. Dozens of them, perhaps hundreds, following her navy. Following her. I saw some of them listening, Gree said. He was standing beside her at the rail, and sensitive though she was, Daria could detect nothing different in his voice, nor how he conversed with her. If anything, he seemed even more respectful. At the dockside? She asked. Gree nodded. Behind you, so you couldn't see. But they were hiding among the fishing nets and cages. Only a few of them, but they must have gone back up into the town and spread the word. He started chuckling. A Bajuman. He laughed some more. A Bajuman is in command of a Quandian fleet. And look at that, Daria said. More vessels sailed with them now, stringing out in a line all the way back into the bay. There must have been 30 small boats floating in their wake. They've only just got here, and now they're leaving again. Maybe they're fools, Gree said. Maybe we are. He did not respond to that. Soon, they would all know the answer. Chapter 14. In the middle of the night, Yaris Teague breathed with his own life, a life of wood and stone and iron nails, the creak and shift of wind and earth upon the structures built by ordinary people. Blaine lay in bed and listened to those familiar night sounds, the living voice of Yaris Teague, so soft that the other nighttime noises seemed loud in comparison. His fellow novices breathed deeply in sleep. Conover snored, as she did nearly every night. The tiny feet of rats or mice scritch-scratched inside the walls, and balls of dust and grit skittered along the floor, carried by the draft that came from nowhere and everywhere at once. Peaceful and quiet, somehow both solid and vulnerable, the darkness enveloped them all. Blaine licked his lips to wet them. The air inside Yaris Teague never used to seem dry to him, but now he always felt parched. He opened his eyes and stared at the ceiling, still unused to the way light lingered for him now. A fortnight earlier, the room would have been so dark he would barely have been able to make out the beams in the ceiling. Now he could see the grain in the wood, the cobwebs in the corners, and the sparkling blue static in the air. For better or worse, he could smell the stink of the other novices on their mats and the blankets that slumbered beneath. Tomorrow was wash day, and Blaine could not wait. He'd only tasted magic thus far, breathed it in, carefully mimicking the things he'd seen Queen Fila doing each time she'd gone down to learn. Every night he threw himself into a series of risks, both in shadowing Fila and the High Order priests who now served her, not to mention the Silent who guarded her, and in touching the magic itself, without anyone there to help him if things went awry. But what other choice did he have? It prickled his skin, dried his mouth all hours of the day, made him alert, even paranoid. He felt it growing in him, as if he had planted a seed inside his flesh and nurtured it. But magic clearly took root faster than any tree or crop. Blaine inhaled, felt it flow, and thought, no wonder they guard it so carefully, this power. And this is only a tiny portion. While they walked the world, the four would have been capable of anything. Of course, they were gods, or perceived as gods. His doubts still prickling, he was not sure the distinction made any real difference. He rolled silently off his mat and crept from the bedchamber. In the corridor, the shadows whispered, and he turned to see a shape stepping quietly in his wake. It ought to have panicked him, but instead Blaine smiled and padded farther down the hall until he reached the stone staircase that led to the cellar and the tunnels beyond. There, two steps down, he turned and waited until the shape appeared. In the dark, with only a thin veil of light from wall sconces back in the corridor, Jemmy's eyes gleamed. "You're up late," he whispered as she took the first step. Jemmy flinched, surprised to find that he'd stopped. In that light, he must have seemed almost a ghost to her. "You've been making a habit of being up late," she said, "going places I'd wager you're forbidden to go." Blaine saw the flush in her face, the skittish way her eyes moved. "And you've been pretending to sleep. You're very good at it." "Where are you going?" she whispered, glancing over her shoulder, seemingly just as anxious as he was that they might be discovered. Blaine took that as a good sign. Blaine moved up so that only a single step separated them. She stood a few inches higher than him, and he had to look up at her, though their bodies were close enough that when next he inhaled, he tasted the warmth of her exhalation, caught the scent of her. That breath came alive in him, the magic he'd tasted turning it into something more, a sampling of her that he found intoxicating. "And so, Charin, god of secrets, lets me delve into hers." For a moment he could only shiver, trying not to meet her gaze, afraid of the intimacy. When Blaine had begun this deception, he had seen the other novices as his enemies, just as he'd viewed all priests that way. And yet, "Do you trust me?" he asked. Jemmy smiled with a fragility unlike her. "What do I say to that? You've been sneaking off in the middle of the night for who knows how long." "Do you trust me?" She stared into his eyes, glanced away. I trust you. With a puff of breath, she met his gaze again. Maybe more than that. But I'm afraid now, can't you see that? With all this talk of magic, the way our teachers, ordinary priests and high order alike, the way they glare at one another, the suspicion and hostility simmering here now that the queen has taken control of the faith. What? It isn't supposed to be like this. I came to the priesthood seeking something, hoping to become something better. Whatever is to come now, it isn't what I envisioned. Blaine took her hand. Even as he did so, he felt the complications that would arise, the entanglement. Yet he held her hand tightly against his chest anyway, almost glad for such mundane problems when compared to his expanding consciousness. Not what I envisioned either, he said. But power is never what it seems on the surface.
The faith is not supposed to be like this,
she breathed. And he could almost hear her pulse quicken. I can't tell you why I'm awake in the middle of the night, Jemmy, he said. Not without putting you in danger. Secrets keep people safe. You can trust me, though, and trust that I wish you only health and happiness. Jemmy placed one hand on his cheek. He felt the skin of her palm, the calluses of her fingers. Rough from their hours of work. The stubble on his chin rasped beneath her touch.
Is that all you wish for me?
She asked. Jemmy slipped down to join him on his step. She wrapped her arms around him, pressed herself against him, and her lips brushed his. Gently at first, and then hungrily. He felt their dryness. Felt the slick texture of her tongue, inhaled the complicated mélange of scents from her skin, her sex, her robe. And then his hands were inside her robe and racing over the hard muscles and soft curves of her. Her fingers dragged open his own robe. She whispered his name. When he braced his back against the wall and lifted her onto him, they both whimpered. Breathless, they crashed into each other, tasted sweat and fear and abandon, and for a brief time all questions of trust were forgotten. It was only afterward, shuddering and spent, and with Jemmy astride him that those questions returned.
I'm not,
Jemmy faltered, smiled, ground down on him a bit, shivering as he did with the echoes of their lovemaking. With a quiet laugh, she grabbed his chin and stared into his eyes, adopting a more serious mien.
I'm not in love with you or anything like that. I just needed this connection.
You needed a friend, Blaine said softly. He gave a gentle thrust and she bit her lip. He kissed that lip, then her throat, and at last they both seemed to breathe more freely. Jemmy put a hand on his chest and pushed backward, rising to sit a couple of steps above him, arranging her robe and closing her legs.
We've broken our vows, she said, studying him.
Blaine shrugged. We've been vow breakers since our first day, friends since our second, in spite of our differences. She pondered that for a moment before she nodded and stood.
Put your cock away and go on about your secrets, friend. But be careful. A little bit of trust is a dangerous thing on Temple Hill lately.
With that, she turned and vanished back into the corridor. Blaine let out a breath and stood, arranged himself, and descended into the cellar, into the tunnels, and then up through the subterranean path that would take him to the Temple of Four. Into that ocean blue room, down the hidden spiral stairs, deeper, and then deeper still, past traps that ought to have killed him and illusions meant to deceive him. In the presence of the Four, the tombs of dead gods, to breathe the magic that still bled from their ancient corpses. But with every step, he could still taste Jemmy on his lips.
Blaine felt as if the Chamber of Tombs kept watch over him with a wary eye, as if taking his measure. The place had no name that he'd heard spoken, but in his mind he'd cherished it in that way. The Chamber of Tombs. Although the phrase felt insufficient. This was no chamber, not even a cavern, but the honeycombed ruin of the first city. The place that had stood in Lartha's place before Lartha had even been built. There were columns down here, halfway crumbled walls, stone edifices that appeared to have been bridges once upon a time. And yet the ruins he saw around him could not be mentally reconstructed into anything resembling a city, as if all the remnants of that ancient place had been collected into this cavern by some desperate curator, while all other evidence of a long-ago society had been scrubbed away. The Chamber of Tombs breathed. It helped him to remain calm and centered, to remind himself of magic's dangers. The core of him, from balls to heart, clawed at the dirt with savage eagerness, wanting the power it felt crackling in the air around him. The urge to take as much magic as he could drink in, to revel in the inferno that these sparks could become, tempted him with every moment he spent in the Chamber of Tombs. He'd seen so many lives lost to Spiza, but the taste of magic made him tremble more than any Spiza addict. Yet he did not succumb. Instead, he simply breathed, relishing the moments, taking his time. Blaine had seen Fila rushing. He had heard the warnings of the High Order, so he deliberately moved more slowly in his rituals than the Queen did in her own. She had skilled priests around her, true magicians there to save her if anything went horribly wrong. Blaine had only echoes. The winking sparks of magic in the air, the impossible lights in corners, the water sluicing down through the rock of the land from the city high above, and the tombs of four beings or gods who had been dead for millennia. On his knees in the pool, still on this side of the veil of water, never daring to go any nearer to the tombs, he stripped to the waist and cupped his hands in the clear blueness. He stared at the intense color for a moment, then drank deeply. He drank again, and a third time, and then splashed the water over his face, anointing himself. Searching within, he found a calm oasis, a place where the seed of magic had been nurtured these past weeks. He began to murmur the words of the fourth rite, which he'd seen Queen Fila intoning the night before.
You are certainly not what I expected.
The voice made Blaine twist around. He tried to rise too quickly and his feet slipped on the slick bottom of the pool, causing him to splash backward onto his arse. Gentle laughter came from the shadows, and for a heartbeat he thought the gods themselves were talking to him. But only for a moment, and he soon realized how foolish such a thought was. Magic muddled minds just like Spiza. The woman stepped into the flickering light, striated patterns of darkness across her body. Blaine swore under his breath.
Not the most graceful, are you, slave?
Blaine scrambled up, at least as far as his knees.
I'm a priest, a novice.
She waved a hand in the air as if the assertion might be smoke she could disperse.
Ah, of course you are. So we'll pretend you're not Bajuman. It's a courtesy I've never quite managed to turn into reality. But then again, you're not quite a novice either, are you? Unless my High Order have changed their teachings dramatically and failed to inform their apex.
Blaine only lowered his gaze, unsure how to reply. He had seen Euphraxia before, of course, but never spoken with her or been this close. A dozen threads spun themselves out in his thoughts. Would he be imprisoned? Cast out of both the faith and the main island? Just another Bajuman to be banished? Or would she have him executed for what he knew? Then another question brushed his mind. What was she doing down here by herself? Euphraxia took another step toward him, entering the edge of the pool. Ripples formed around her ankles, and she stood staring down at him.
I'm speaking to you, novice. Yes, Apex.
What else could he say?
I heard you whispering just now. I heard the words of a ritual you can't possibly have been taught, unless some renegade faction within the faith is working to turn more priests into magicians without my approval. And I can think of only one reason anyone might do such a thing.
Blaine blinked, the logic coalescing slowly.
No, Apex, there's no...
treachery.
Apex, I swear to you. No one knows I'm here but you.
Euphraxia knelt before him in the pool, water soaking into the fine fabric of her robe, so different from the rough things the rest of the priesthood wore. Her eyes were dark and gleaming with cruel intellect.
If only I could believe you. Once I might have, but I've had spies in my own house. Murder, novice. I've had murder in my own house.
I don't know anything about...
Yet, even if I did believe you, I'd have no choice. You see, nobody knows I'm here either.
Blaine's throat had been dry before, but now it seemed to shrink.
What was she saying? How did this make any sense? No choice,
he echoed. The Apex clicked her tongue. None. She lifted a hand. The fingers twirled and danced, and her lips moved with words so quiet that even there, so close, with so little other sound to compete with her voice, Blaine could not hear more than a syllable or two. Yet he knew the contortions of her fingers, had heard those syllables before. And a chill went through him, a cold resignation. He swore inwardly, pressed his eyes closed, and when he opened them, he saw the figures that had manifested in the cavern around them. The phage. There were four of them, moving like swift mist with no weight of their own. They had weapons at their hips, swords and daggers that seemed nothing but gray smoke until they touched them. The phage themselves seemed to vanish where the light touched them and appear fully formed only where shadows ought to have hidden them, as if they were the opposite of ordinary flesh and bone. And perhaps they were.
Please, Apex, Blaine said, holding his hands out to her. I can...
But what could he say to her that would change what was about to happen? The truth would condemn him faster than any lie. Sorrow crushed him as he understood that his people would never be free. The magic prickled his skin, crackled in the air all through the cavern, let him smell the anger and the curiosity and the bitterness of the woman before him. None of that would save him. It had all been a waste, a pantomime of false hope.
Kill him, Euphraxia said. Take the body so deep, even the four couldn't find it.
The phage slipped toward him in a shimmering flow.
Please don't,
Blaine whispered, talking to them now, to the dead, for he knew the Apex had no mercy. As if those words had unfrozen his limbs, he scrambled backward in the water, splashing deeper into the pool around the tombs. Water sluiced across his back, and he realized he stood beneath the falling curtain of rain, piercing the liquid veil that separated the tombs on their wide raised area from the rest of the cavern. The phage came on faster. Inside his skull he heard a low keening as if they screamed, but only the most ancient part of him could hear it. Their mouths were wide and their hands reached out, fingers grasping air, lunging for his throat. Euphraxia might as well have vanished for all she mattered to him now.
No,
he screamed, and he shot his hands out to defend himself. He felt the tides within him, an ebb and flow of power, and was surprised when the water leaped up into a clear blue wall, rushing upward from the pool to shield him.
The phage collided with it, and the water flowed against them, shoving them backward half a dozen steps before they blinked out of reality, and then back in again, closer to Blaine than before. Blaine stood straighter and took a step away from the veil.
"What did you just do?"
Euphraxia asked, striding into his peripheral vision to his left.
"Did Daphine bless you? Did she protect you?"
The Apex thought that damned gods had taken an interest in him. Maybe that would help him. Maybe she would also take an interest and spare him if he let her believe that. But Blaine had hidden himself and lowered his gaze and bent his back for the wealthy and privileged long enough. He'd felt the water rise, felt the connection between himself and the fabric of the world around him. He had made that happen. Not any god, true or not.
"I protected myself," he said,
and he reached out and muttered a string of words as he brought the shield of water up from the pool again. He smashed it against the phage, knowing that to surprise them and push them back had been a trick that would work only once. But there were other elements and rituals he'd read or seen practiced by the High Order and the Queen. He'd never have believed himself capable, but now he had seen the power at his disposal, and he felt it surge within him. Yet there was still so much he didn't know. The magic was there, but could he actually wield it against the phage? They screamed inside his skull again, crying out from the void of death. Blaine looked at the one he could tell was Bajamin.
"I'm doing this for you," he said to it. "For all of us."
Did the phage warrior hesitate? Perhaps. But the others careened toward him again, shifting through and past the water he brought up in his defense. They drew their weapons and the blades and spikes grew solid. Blaine shouted for them to stop, tried to call the wind against them, felt the bones of his spine and the stone beneath his feet tremble with the awakening of magic he did not yet know.
"Enough!"
Euphraxia barked. The phage ignored her and tore at his robes, dragging him up out of the water, feet dangling beneath him. One lifted its ghostly hand holding a glimmering blade. Euphraxia clapped her small hands. The sound blew through the cavern with such force that the water and the air and the fabric of the phage themselves rippled with it. They dropped Blaine, darting away from him, and stood at wary attention as Blaine crashed into the pool, both fuming and yet resigned, ready to die. He rose to his feet again. But the phage did not attack. The Apex walked toward Blaine, eyes narrowed as she examined him.
"You're an odd one," said the woman who'd ordered his death only moments before. "How is it you know what you do? You've learned a bit of magic, exposed yourself to the breath of the Four. And yet you don't appear to have gone mad. No drool, no ruined eyes, no blood or magic seeping from your orifices. Not the ones I can see."
"Nor the ones you can't see," Blaine said, watching her, twitching his gaze over to glance at the phage, waiting for her curiosity to end in his death.
"Smart, too, or so it seems, strong-willed. Most Bajumin are broken things."
"Broken at birth by people like you," he replied, surprising himself with the freedom of his tongue. With death so near, why not speak his mind? He'd already decided the time for pretense had ended.
"You haven't answered me. How have you learned
magic?" "I know a bit. What I've learned, I gleaned as Per Ristolo and the others introduced the Queen to the rituals every night. I follow. They're teaching her."
"Ah,"
the Apex said, inhaling deeply.
"It begins to make sense now. They teach her, and don't know they're teaching you as well."
"Something like that," Blaine said. Euphraxia approached him, hands at her sides.
"You could be useful to me, novice.
There is a rift in the faith. I'm aware. I have no doubt you are. Have you chosen a side? I'm Bajuman. You're a priest of the faith. You've left all affiliations behind. And you, Apex? Did you leave all your old affiliations behind, all those years ago when you first joined the priesthood?
You are smart, Euphraxia smiled. You've heard, then, that Queen Phila rescinded her mother's edict. She saved the lives of 11,000 Bajumen.
Only to banish them, drive them from their homes, send them off into the world with nothing to their names, to live or die as fate would decree.
So you have chosen a side.
I'm Bajumen. That is my side.
But you'd agree? We share certain interests.
In the immediate future, without a doubt, Blaine admitted. We'd both like to see Phila dead or imprisoned, or banished herself. Past that, I can make no promises. My aims may not be the same as yours.
You say this knowing that I could kill you where you stand. I'm not sure if that's brave or idiotic. But for the moment, it's enough. I think you'll be useful to me. As long as you are, you'll have my support. For now, continue as you've been. Learn what you can. Harsh times are coming. Perhaps even war. If and when that happens, I'll summon you into my service.
That's it? You trust me to just go on my way? What if I go straight to Persantiger?
The Apex laughed.
You won't do that.
I won't. If you do, I'll kill you and all the novices in your class.
With a wave from the Apex, the phage vanished. The casual display of power chilled Blaine to the core and excited him at the same time.
Go now, Euphraxia said, turning her back on him and kneeling in the pool, bowing her head toward the tombs of the gods.
They whispered to me, and I must have silence if I am to hear them and whisper in return.
Blaine didn't hesitate, although he yearned to hear the whispers between the Apex and whatever responded. He knew he had already tempted his fortune enough tonight. He left the Chamber of Tombs and headed back toward the surface. Everything had changed, but it would take time for him to discover whether that change would help him fulfill his ambitions or destroy them completely. His body still trembled with the after effects of the magic he'd conjured, the excitement of it, and the prickling static left behind by his tapping of the sparking, glittering energy of that power. Quietly, secretly, he had just chosen sides in a war not his own. Deimos did not feel safe, no matter what the tavern keeper said. He sat on the floor in a pantry at the back of the tavern amid cobwebs and shelves of dry goods and canned fruits and drying vegetables. There were sticky pots on the floor, spilled grains, squashed spiders, a rotten shirazi pepper, and a broad scattering of little brown dots that looked suspiciously like mouse turds. No sign of mice as yet, but he thought perhaps when the hour turned a bit later they would appear. The walls were thin, a general tumult punctuated by moments of uproarious laughter reached him, and part of him felt warmed. It was good to hear laughter again, to know that despite the chaos and murder and the rising oppression in Qandis, people could still find things to make them forget their troubles. Footsteps creaked overhead where there were rooms for let, some of them with long-term occupants, and others filled an hour at a time. Deimos had never been inside the Snake's Tail Tavern before, but he'd known of it most of his life. He'd never crossed the threshold because he was the son of Baron Callistrate, and surely would be Baron himself one day. His father had schooled him on the lessons of avoiding the appearance of impropriety. The irony sickened him. The Snake's Tail was perched on the edge of the River Susk,
right at the base of Palace Hill and in the shadow of Scholar's Bridge, the oldest and most ornate of the 77 bridges in Lartha. Scholar's Bridge connected Palace Hill to Hartshorn Hill, where the historians and educators of the kingdom made their home. Deimos had always held a great deal of respect for Clan Hartshorn. He wondered what they made of Fila now. He shifted position. The mat upon which he sat had its share of stains whose history he preferred never to discover. Uncomfortable and filthy, it had seen nothing but better days, and he had a feeling he knew what the tavern keeper used it for, there in the dry pantry. Come on, Tolliver, he thought. The boy had been gone 4 hours at least, and there was little Deimos could do to combat his boredom and anxiety. Out in the tavern there would be many who knew his face. He'd spent 2 nights in a barn, and now here he was. He might have visited a dozen homes, but there was no way to know the allegiances of his former allies and friends. And even if he could be certain, they had servants and cousins and neighbors. Here at the base of Palace Hill, at the very least, Mirren would not have to go far. That was if Tolliver could deliver on his promises, if the kitchen slave who fed the strays behind the palace truly was the Bajamin boy's cousin, through some interbreeding no one would dare admit. But Deimos had learned to trust the boy. He'd learned also that he knew nothing about the inner world of Quandian slaves, their cultures and relationships, and even less when the topic narrowed itself down to Bajamin. He was at the mercy of this boy whose presence he'd have ignored not long ago. Because you're a fool, he'd told himself. There was no part of him that wished to argue the point. A creak and scuff came from beyond the pantry door, and Deimos froze. Footsteps approached, and he picked up the long kitchen knife he'd taken while passing through. As quietly as possible, he shifted forward off the mat, crouched on one knee in the slash of light that came through the gap between door and frame. The door opened, his grip tightened. He expected to see Tolliver, but was taking no chances. And indeed, it was not Tolliver, but a smiling, beautiful serving girl, a mass of curly hair bouncing as she turned away from the man she'd led to the pantry by hand. Deimos saw it all clearly in that first instant, the playful gleam in her eyes, the way she shushed her would-be lover, the dirty mat upon which he'd been sitting, available for anyone who might want it. Framed in the lamplight from the dingy kitchen, the girl looked fragile and beautiful. She was laughing and so sweet that it took Deimos an extra second to see that the lucky bastard she'd tugged by the hand wore the uniform of the city guard. Fucking hells, Deimos rasped. The serving girl let out a little gasp and froze in place. The guardsman's lustful grin turned to a scowl at the interruption. But Deimos saw the moment when irritation turned to recognition. The man's eyes narrowed, and he took a step backward. A moment's hesitation, that was all. And then he'd shout an alarm and there would be others, and Deimos would be enslaved again. Or dead. The girl squeaked as Deimos lunged, shoved her aside, and thrust the kitchen knife through the guardsman's throat. He felt the dull, dirty blade punch through skin and muscle, and then blood sluiced along its length and showered to the floor. He left the knife where it had lodged and spun toward the girl. She drew a deep breath to scream, and he was on her, one hand over her mouth. She clawed at his arms and punched him in the temple hard enough that his grip slipped for a moment, and she managed half a shout before he struck her silent. She crashed into shelves full of grain sacks and jarred fruits and fell to her knees, torn bags spilling grain down on top of her. She took a breath. Deimos put a finger to his lips. Shh! Don't die for this. The warning stilled her. Before she could think it over, he dragged the dead guardsman away from the door and closed her inside. The ruckus had been loud, but the laughter and boisterous conversation in the tavern was louder. Still, he had no idea how much time he might have,
and he needed to be somewhere else when the next person entered the kitchen. The tavern keeper had been willing to help, but a dead guardsman on his floor would almost certainly make him reconsider. He glanced at the kitchen knife jutting from the man's throat, then at the sword that hung in its scabbard at his hip. Deimos opted for the sword, unbelted it, and then fastened it around his own waist, so the scabbard hung on his left hip. As he rushed for the back door, he paused a moment. There had to be some way for him to leave a message for Tolliver so the boy could find him. But then the serving girl began to shout, not as terrified of Deimos as he'd hoped. He had run out of time. The door latch stuck a moment, but he muscled it open, knocking rust away and stumbling out into the half-moon night. In the shadows behind the tavern, garbage and broken tables and chairs had been stacked high. The smell rushed into his nose, but he ignored it, making for the trees that lined the road, already focused on the darkness beneath the Scholar's Bridge. Perhaps there he could find a little boat and escape along the river. At this moment, escape was the only thing he could focus on. He would return for Mirren at some point, and for his mother. But it wouldn't be long before the city guard found their dead man and began tearing every house apart searching for his killer. Deimos had no doubt that Queen Fila would give them a long leash. His thoughts churned. If he stayed, they'd catch him for sure, maybe kill him on the spot. If he fled, at least he might figure a way out of this. It might also allow him time to get a message to Mirren, even if only to warn her about Euphraxia's plan for rebellion. With that information, the queen might still spare him. A path led through a copse of trees on the hillside. He raced toward the deeper shadows there and nearly stumbled when he spotted two figures emerging from the trees. Out in the yellow gloom of the half-moon night, he was exposed, with no chance of going unnoticed. He drew his stolen sword, hoping he would not have to bloody it. Then he saw the way the smaller figure hurried, and how the taller one glanced back the way they'd come, as if worried they might be pursued. He saw the determination in her stride and knew. He ran to her. Mirren met him there under the half moon. Tolliver urged them in hushed tones to move swiftly. But still Deimos took her in his arms and she kissed him. Wanted for murder. An escaped slave. His face known throughout the city. Still, he had never felt so free. Chapter 15. The port town of Suskmith had seen its share of ships over the years, but never anything like the strange flotilla that sailed into its harbor that morning. On the deck of her flagship, Daria watched through her telescope as fishermen stopped in the midst of unloading their morning haul to stare at the naval ships and the motley array of boats that accompanied them. Children playing on the dock ceased their games and skirmishes and ran the length of the longest pier to gaze in wonder. On either side of the mouth of the river, men and women began to gather. Daria knew that what they saw must have felt ominous to them, and it was no surprise when she spotted the full complement of Suskmith's army garrison taking up positions along the dock and harbor wall. Hidden away behind the fortifications, gun crews would be zeroing their aim. Good, she thought. It was important that they see her coming. The ship swayed in the harbor and the anchor chain rattled as it unspooled. The crew scampered among the masts, lowering the sails.
Ready to go ashore, Admiral?
Captain Gree asked, striding along the deck toward her. Daria closed the telescope and held it in her left hand. Three sailors had followed in Captain Gree's wake, and now stood at attention behind him. The one woman among them stood a head taller than any of the men, as dark as cooled lava, an outlander from one of the volcanic islands on the eastern edge of the ring. Her name was Sujita, and aside from Deimos Callistrate, Daria had never served with a better fighter, or one more loyal. It helped her to know that sailors like Sujita had stayed with her, despite her revelation. Others had refused to serve under her command. But in truth, Daria had expected many more to abandon her. If Sujita had stayed, it wasn't just out of loyalty to her admiral. It meant she believed in the fight, and that was heartening. "These are the three you've chosen?" she asked.
"You said three who could fight but were smart enough to know when to keep their mouths shut," Captain Grease said. "Hard to find that combination in sailors."
Daria studied the three of them again. Sujita, a man called Lorizzo, whom she knew was a devil with a sword in his hand, and a third who seemed too young for this mission. "I don't know you," she said, pausing in her inspection to study him a bit closer.
"Name's Hudnall, sir. Honored, sir."
Captain Grease smiled.
"Hudnall's been cooking for us since the last time we left port. The young man's got a gift when it comes to turning tasteless ingredients into something palatable. Last week I saw him scrap with Bosper in the mess hall. Trust me, he can more than handle himself."
"That true, Hudnall?" Daria asked. The sailor, no more than 18, stood a bit straighter, unwilling to meet her gaze.
"True enough, Admiral. I don't like a scrap, but ain't ever lost one."
"Good enough for me," Daria said. She walked to the railing and looked out at the fishing boats and skiffs, some of which should never have made it this far from the ring, all of them filled with Bajiman slaves ready and willing to fight. "And this? Putting together an army that's half composed of rabble most sailors never notice unless they want a chamber pot emptied, or a secret fuck that no one will ever speak of? You're willing to fight alongside Bajuman?" None of them spoke, not even Captain Gree. The ship creaked, a pulley clanged against the foremast, and the shouts of the crews going about their duties filled the air. Daria turned to face Gree and his three hand-picked sailors, her personal guard to go ashore, these three, and it haunted her that there weren't more she knew well, more she trusted. Deimos would have been her first choice, her right hand, but he was not here. "And what will he think," she wondered, "when he learns what you are? Will it be the same as with Shar? Will he shun you?"
"Nothing to say?" she prodded. "We're with you, Admiral Halardi," Sujita said. "Yesterday, today, and tomorrow."
Daria exhaled. She studied Lorizzo, who only nodded, one hand resting on the pommel of his sword. That left only the boy, Hudnall, who muttered something quietly.
"Speak up,"
Captain Grease snapped. Hudnall raised his eyes and stared at Daria.
"Permission to speak freely, Admiral?"
"By all means, if we're all going to be getting to know one another better. You'll all need to speak your minds when we're alone, and keep quiet when we're not."
Hudnall glanced at the deck and gave a little shrug.
"I'm a quarter Bajuman myself."
Gree, Lorizzo, and Sujita all turned to gaze at him in surprise.
"A quarter," Daria repeated.
"My mother's mother," Hudnall said quietly. "Always been ashamed of it."
He glanced out at the dozens of little boats around them, then met her eyes again.
"Until now, Admiral. I'm with you. Whatever it takes."
Lorizzo grinned.
"I'm a fucking heathen, Admiral. No Penter, mind you, just a common everyday atheist. The priests up on Temple Hill might be full of shit, but at least for the most part they seem to want what's best for Qandis. Our new queen, though. If she's killing nobles and slaughtering or banishing a whole race, taking over the fucking faith by force. Well, I was never too fond of the idea of monarchy to begin with."
Sujita burst into laughter so infectious that even Daria couldn't help smiling.
"What do you find so amusing?"
Lorizzo sniffed.
"Haven't heard you say more than three words at a time since I met you. I wasn't sure you knew that many of them," the towering woman said.
Captain Greed took a step forward and clicked his heels together, standing at attention.
"If they'll do, Admiral, it's time for you to go ashore. Dinghy's waiting."
"Let's do it then," Daria said, smile fading. "Time to see whose side the Sucksmith garrison will be on."
The Admiral led the way, with this new contingent of her loyalists falling in behind her. Ever since her revelation, she'd been wary of the crew, wondering what might be going on aboard the other four ships under her command. Thus far, there had been no mutiny, no desertion. But they were at the main island of Quandis now, with the capital a day's hard ride inland. If any of them were having second thoughts, she would know soon enough. "Captain," she said, as she reached the thick rope ladder that led down to the dinghy. Hesitating a moment, she reached inside her jacket to withdraw a small envelope bearing her seal in blue wax. When Daria spoke again, she lowered her voice, but put her back to the others so that only Captain Gree might hear. "Do we have a runner left in the fleet who has half a brain?" Visibly stifling his curiosity, the captain nodded. "Fissile on the Royal Dawn. Quick and quiet as a mouse, smarter than average. Too ugly for anyone's eyes to linger over long upon his face." Daria handed him the envelope. "Get this to Fissile. Your hand to his, Captain. Have him deliver it to Yaris Teague, to a novice priest named Blaine, and to no one else." "It shall be done. No one else," Daria repeated. Then she started down the rope ladder. Her shore team had already piled into the dinghy. Her sword and other weapons were heavy at her hip, but the weight felt satisfying. Whatever happened now, there would be no going back. Sujita pushed off and Lorizzo began to row. It felt as if time had begun to speed up. The waves rocked them and the morning sun burned its way across the sky. Up and down the harbor were the little boats of the Bajaman, who had fled this island only weeks ago. And now they were returning to the place from which they'd been forced, and the lives that had been torn away from them. Daria might not look like one of them anymore, but not since she had been beaten half to death and chucked into the water had she felt so much like a Bajaman. At the pier, they were met by half a dozen rough fishermen, an officious little man who claimed to speak for the mayor of Susquehanna, and roughly 40 soldiers garrisoned in the town. There'd be another force on the other side of the river's mouth, in the old fort that perched there, and from which they could control the boom that blocked boats from entering the river without authorization. There would be cannons at the ready behind the low stone walls, too. She wasn't exactly worried. She'd left her forces with instructions to ready their own guns. The five battleships could blast and flatten Susquehanna's seafront in a matter of minutes, if the need arose. Daria waited until the first of the faded fishing boats pulled up behind her dinghy. She caught the eye of the old Ring Islander piloting that boat, and an aging but formidable-looking Bajaman. She nodded to the two men, and they did the same in return. Only then did Daria step off onto the floating dock and start up to the pier with Hudnall, Sujita, Lorizzo, and three Bajaman from that fishing boat walking up the ramp behind her. On the pier, the fishermen backed away, leaving the mayor's bootlick and the soldiers to greet them. The garrison's lieutenant stepped forward, one hand on the hilt of a dagger in her belt, casually, as if this was her natural pose. Then, as if only now remembering protocol, she snapped to attention and saluted. "Raise the boom, Lieutenant," Daria said. "Admiral Hallardy, welcome back to Susquehanna." She glanced at the Bajaman in confusion. Have you returned to answer Queen Fila's summons for assistance?" Daria smiled. To her left, Lorizzo shifted lightly, his hand only inches from the grip of his sword. "In a sense, I have," she replied. "But you seem nervous, Lieutenant. Are you distracted by the presence of Bajaman? Surely not, given these very same thousands passed through Susquehanna only recently, and were given your kind assistance in departing. Now, again I ask you, raise the boom." The lieutenant had shaved the left side of her head and tattooed it with images of sea monsters from the outer ring. In Lartha, she'd have been stripped of her rank and set to digging ditches, but here she was in command. "I'm not distracted by them, Admiral," she said, "though I'm forced to wonder about their return so soon after their banishment.
You know the Queen has ordered that any Bajamin remaining on the main island are to be executed.
Here came the moment, then. Daria rose to her full height, made sure she wore no trace of a smile.
The sea and the gods and the grip of death changed me, Lieutenant. But I'm Bajamin myself. My eyes don't give me away. But once they were the same winter blue as the rest of my people.
A ripple of angry muttering swept the garrison soldiers and the fishermen. The mayor's bootlick recoiled so completely that he stumbled and bumped into a soldier, who rudely brushed him aside.
Someone in the crowd called her a deceitful whore, but most of those murmurs were more of shock than condemnation. Most.
Daria saw a flurry of movement to her left. A short, stocky soldier knelt and brought up the small crossbow from his belt, aiming past her left shoulder toward the Bajamin behind her. She reacted quickly, plucking a throwing star from her belt and letting it fly in the same movement. It whistled through the air and struck the soldier in the throat. His eyes went wide. He coughed, gagged, and when he tugged the razor-sharp blade from his flesh, blood began to spurt.
Two more soldiers stepped forward and aimed their crossbows, but Sujita was already moving, darting forward and piercing one soldier through the face with her sword. The other ducked down and back, switching his aim to Sujita.
Daria felt the air swish past her ear as a short spear flew and found its mark in the soldier's gut.
He went down, and Hudnall darted past her ready to finish the job.
"Wait," Daria said. Sword in her hand, she knew that Lorenzo and the three Bajamin were also crouched and ready to fight. Mere seconds had passed, but already three soldiers were down, two dead or dying, the other badly wounded.
"Wait," she said again, and she looked the lieutenant in the eye.
"Stand fast," the lieutenant shouted. "Is nobody going to do anything?" the mayor's man cried. "She's standing right there. She's just told you she's Bajamin, and she's brought them all back. The Queen!"
A huge soldier covered the politician's whole face with one giant hand and shoved him backward. The man's arms pinwheeled, and others got out of the way. And if he hadn't fallen and bounced his skull off the pier, he'd have gone off the side and into the drink.
"He's not wrong," another soldier said, sneering as he glanced at the lieutenant. "Fucking Bajamin trash. And we're meant to salute her? Cut off her head, and Her Majesty'll pin a medal on your chest."
The lieutenant glanced at her fallen men. She studied the trio of sailors around Daria, looked at the Bajamin there on the pier with them, and then out at the warships and the long line of motley vessels that had brought the banished slaves back home.
"No question about it, Admiral," the lieutenant said. "Forgive my impulsive troops, but you've put me in a bad spot. I should lock you in irons, deliver you to Lartha, or just save the time and kill you right here."
"You can try," Daria replied. The lieutenant shifted nervously.
"What are you doing here, Admiral? If you're not coming to help the Queen put down the unrest in the capital."
Daria liked the monster tattoos on her scalp, and the way her remaining hair hung in a jagged curtain on the other side. She liked the glint of mischief in the woman's eyes. She did not want to kill her.
"Queen Fila has declared herself leader of the faith," Daria said. "She's silencing all those who would oppose her with intimidation, death, or imprisonment. She's executed members of the nobility, and others, and is defying generations of tradition and understanding. We've come to—"
"Traitorous Bajamin bitch!"
shouted the soldier who'd wanted her head. He rushed forward, drawing a dagger from his belt. Daria rolled her eyes as she prepared to defend herself. But before she needed to do more, the lieutenant tripped the soldier, giving him a shove to help him along the way, and the man went tumbling off the pier. He struck the ramp on the way down and cried out in pain, then splashed into the water.
"Anyone else wanting to act without my orders?" the lieutenant shouted, turning her back on Daria to face her troops.
She plucked a dropped crossbow from the ground, checked its draw, walked to the edge of the harbor,
and shot the soldier she'd just sent splashing into the water. The bolt hit him in the eye. Anyone else? I fucking did.